This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, is a revived Iran nuclear deal within reach? What has changed since the deal was brokered by the Obama-Biden administration in 2015 and then abandoned by the Trump administration in 2018? Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. In early March, I hosted a discussion on the status of the nuclear deal with Iran, also known as the JCPOA, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. At the time, Russia, one of the six international partners, along with the United States, Britain, France, China, and Germany, involved in reviving the deal, posed an obstacle. Moscow was demanding written guarantees from the United States that Western sanctions targeting Russia over its invasion of Ukraine would not affect its trade with Iran. The six parties found a way to surmount this hurdle, but more than 2 months later, another, seemingly intractable one, remains before sealing the deal. Tehran is demanding that the United States remove the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps from the U.S. terror blacklist. Numerous press reports indicate that this is a non-starter. Washington is not inclined to remove the IRGC from the list of state sponsors of terrorism. And according to Barbara Slavin, as time goes by, quote, the appetite for compromise seems to be diminishing. There is a sense that given domestic constraints and the much more compelling crisis in Ukraine, the parties to the Iran deal are willing to live with an extended limbo that requires no gestures on either side that would cause them to lose face. Close quote. This, despite the fact that a majority of Americans now support the agreement, which was not the case in 2015. Nonetheless, Barbara Slavin says in an article for the online news site Instic that Republicans insist, without evidence, that Iran is determined to get a bomb, and some Democrats don't like the optics of removing the Foreign Terrorist Organization designation from the IRGC, even if it has almost no real-world consequences. However, Slavin also says that the Iran deal is not dead and that Washington considers it consistent with its national interests. Significantly, the EU mediator in the indirect talks between the U.S. and Iran met with the Iranian chief negotiator on Wednesday in an effort to salvage the deal. Reporting for the online news site Al Monitor, Ali Hashem says that the Emir of Qatar, Sheikh Tamim bin Hamad, arrived in Tehran on Thursday, May 12, to discuss ways of overcoming the current impasse. Hashem says, quote, the timing sheds great light on the effort made by Doha to reconcile the United States and the Islamic Republic. It is not known what Qatar has in store, but it is certain that Doha has a real interest in creating a space for dialogue between the two opponents with whom it has good relations. Close quote. On Tuesday, a Qatari-owned newspaper reported that Iranian President Ibrahim Raisi is set to visit Oman. The report came after an Iranian foreign ministry spokesman had confirmed the president has plans to visit two Persian Gulf countries. Well, for more on the renewed diplomacy, beginning with our March discussion of the impediment precipitated by Moscow, we turn to two distinguished regional experts. Barbara Slavin is director of the Future of Iran Initiative at the Atlantic Council. That's a think tank here in Washington. Previously, Barbara was a Cairo and Beijing correspondent for The Economist magazine and diplomatic reporter for USA Today. She's also author of Bitter Friends and Bosom Enemies, Iran, the U.S., and the Twisted Path to Confrontation. And Andrea Stricker. She's a research fellow at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, a Washington-based policy group. She is an expert on nuclear weapons proliferation and illicit procurement networks. She is the co-author of numerous books, such as Taiwan's Former Nuclear Weapons Program. And both women join me via Microsoft Teams. Barbara Slavin, welcome back to the program.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
And Andrea Stricker, welcome to you.
Thank you very much.
Barb Slavin, let me get you to react first. Before we get into the merits and the drawbacks of the revised deal, what's your assessment, Barb, of the last minute Russian wrinkle, so to speak?
Sure. Look, I think we had all hoped somehow that the invasion of Ukraine would not intrude on these talks, which have been going on for almost a year now in Vienna. But unfortunately, I think the Russians have seen an opportunity to get some additional advantages out of it that are not part of the the deal. The efforts of all these negotiators in Vienna is to get back to the 2015 agreement as closely as possible, not to add new conditions.
So turning to Andrea Stricker for your take on the monkey wrench that Russia threw into the talks.
So Russia's chief Iran nuclear deal negotiator, Ambassador Ulyanov, is echoing demands made by Russian Foreign Minister Lavrov that they need guarantees that Moscow's trade and their economic relations with Iran will not be subject to any sanctions from the West. Now, what does this mean? It means that even if the West, the United States, Europe, have sanctioned a particular Russian bank, company, or export, Moscow wants exemptions to be able to carry out that trade with Iran per the terms of the JCPOA. But ultimately, Russia wants Washington and the Europeans to agree in writing that they'll permit these sorts of sanctions loopholes, even despite our effort to contain and prevent and stop this invasion of Ukraine. I think Russia has overreached here. I think Barbara probably agrees there. And they risk not getting this deal done in a timely way that they've worked so long and hard on.
Barb, back to you. To what extent the Russians have a lot of leverage here? What's your take?
Yeah, I do agree that they've overreached. You know, there are other countries that can take the excess enriched uranium from Iran that can provide the cooperation on the nuclear front that Russia was providing. If they continue to go down this path, I mean, it's possible that other provisions would be made. But the unfortunate thing is that I think there are still some doubts, particularly in Iran, about the value of returning to the agreement. And the longer the time goes on, the more interruptions there are, the more distractions, the more it makes me nervous that we may not get back into the agreement. Many Iranians question the value of returning when it's entirely possible that if a Republican is elected president in 2024, that Republican will withdraw again the way that Trump did. So is it worth it for a couple of years of sanctions relief? I argue that it is, especially when oil is at over $100 a barrel. But I do worry about all of these delays.
So back to you, Andrew, to get your take on the delays and to what extent Russia can throw this monkey wrench in and scuttle the deal.
Well, I think it really exposes some of the inherent contradictions in the deal. For one, that we're allowing Moscow, which is becoming, you know, the 21st century's Hitler's Germany, to negotiate an accord that we expect to be in U.S. interests. And not surprisingly, it's not. This is because the deal, we've already lived through over 6 years of it. So now we're essentially facing the expiration in phases of many of the nuclear provisions. Under the terms of the 2015 deal, Iran was allowed to continue enriching uranium. It was allowed to do research and development on faster, more advanced centrifuges. That allowed it to hop ahead once the Trump administration pulled out of the deal in 2018. So we don't want to legalize what we're seeing today. And that's essentially what the JCPOA would do. Iran can start growing its advanced centrifuge program starting in 2024, can stockpile more than 2,000 of its fastest centrifuges by 2029, on top of the 2,000 or more it already has now and will have in storage under the deal. And then all the restrictions will end at the start of 2031. This isn't like an arms control agreement between the Soviet Union, Russia, and the United States, where you have caps or reductions that can be renewed at the end. It's actually just a lifting of the nuclear restrictions and a growing of Iran's nuclear capabilities.
All right. Well, now you're getting into the merits and the drawbacks of the deal itself, in addition to the obstacles that are coming into focus with regard to whether or not this is actually going to happen. Barb already mentioned the fact that Republicans are talking about if they come into power that they would pull out, and Iran is very concerned about that. And that's another condition, right, Barb, that the Iranians want some kind of guarantee that the United States would not withdraw again. So in addition to that and the many criticisms that Andrea just outlined, what other sticking points do you see that could scuttle the deal?
Yeah, let's go back to the basic analysis of the deal. What Andrea said is partly true, but not entirely. Iran has pledged never to develop nuclear weapons. That's in the preamble to the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. That's also in the fact that Iran is a member of the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty and has been since its inception. What expires, and this is not until 2031, is the requirement that Iran possess no more than 300 kilograms of low-enriched uranium. And you can't make make a bomb with 300 kilograms of low-enriched uranium. So I think we would be lucky to get back into this agreement. We unfortunately only had a brief period of proper implementation because of the Trump administration's disastrous decision to pull out of the deal when Iran was in full compliance with it. That's what gave Iran the leeway to restart elements of its program that were curbed under the JCPOA. So I think the job ahead is to get back into the agreement and then try to strengthen it, perhaps extend it if possible, but not to simply throw up our hands and say, well, it's not worth it anymore. In terms of other problems, yes, the Iranians want some sort of guarantee, which they understand that the Biden administration cannot provide. At least only Biden can say that through his administration, the U.S. would remain committed to the agreement. There are also still apparently some disagreements over which entities that have been sanctioned by the Trump administration will have those designations removed. I think one particular sticking point has been Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, which is sanctioned under multiple American entities and provisions, including the Treasury Department and so on. But the State Department declared that the Revolutionary Guards, which are a very important part of Iran's military, declared that this was a foreign terrorist organization. And that is the particular sanction that Iran is asking be lifted. Frankly, it's a meaningless designation given all the other restrictions there are on dealing with this body. And I think it's a point of pride for the Iranians that their military not be labeled terrorists.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. You're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. My guests are Barbara Slavin, Director of the Future of Iran Initiative at the Atlantic Council, from whom you just heard, and Andrea Stricker. She's research fellow specializing in nuclear issues at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. We are discussing the status of stalled talks in Vienna over the revived nuclear deal with Iran. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel, VOA. Well, here's a shout out to a loyal Facebook fan, Guru Divyansh Singh from Ahmedabad, India. If you want to hear your name and home country on the air, please send an email to encounter@voanews.com, or you can always like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, back to you, Andrea Stricker, to talk about the deal as it is currently outlined to respond to some of Barb's points. For example, she said that, with all due respect, that it was former President Trump's withdrawal from the deal, unilateral pulling out of the deal, that gave Iran, you know, leeway to accelerate its program in many ways. And the question then to you would be, given your criticisms of the deal, what is the alternative? For example, there's a possible risk of a nuclear strike by Israel or giving Iran a faster path to a nuclear weapon. What is your viable alternative?
Sure. I mean, reasonable people can argue about whether the Trump administration should have left the deal instead of negotiating something longer term or to repair the so-called sunsets or expirations of the provisions. Ideally, we would revert back to a multilateral pressure campaign with our European counterparts. We would go back to massive economic pressure to hopefully quickly force the regime to make hard choices about its nuclear program. The maximum pressure campaign just didn't have enough time to sort of force that choice. The oil sanctions weren't in place long enough. We also need to support the Iranian people in their effort to secure a better government. But I would just like to respond to a couple things. On the pledge under the JCPOA that Iran would not make nuclear weapons, as Barbara mentioned, they already pledged not to make nuclear weapons under the Non-Proliferation Treaty, and they reneged on that promise. We know that up until 2003, they had a very robust nuclear weapons program. We learned this from files that Israel seized in 2018, that they decided to hide and better camouflage weaponization activities of the program. And under the JCPOA, the nuclear watchdog, the UN nuclear watchdog, has never been able to determine that those projects have ended, despite having some tough monitoring provisions. They've never actually used them to go in and determine that these weaponization activities are alive or not alive and not progressing still today. So a kind of deal that we would want would address issues like that, fundamental questions about the peacefulness of Iran's nuclear program.
Barb, I know you're itching to get it.
Yeah, I think what Andrea is referring to is research that Iran did almost 20 years ago now, in some cases more than 20 years ago. And the International Atomic Energy Agency does have some questions about that program still. But I would point out that in the threats assessment that is presented to Congress every year, the CIA and the Director of National Intelligence both said that there was no indication that Iran had resumed any of this weapons work, no indication that Iran had made any decision to go for a nuclear weapon. So I think it's a question about whether you're going to let the future be hostage to the past. Whatever Iran may have done in the past, it never developed nuclear weapons. And I think we have to work as hard as possible to make sure it doesn't go the route of North Korea, which also had an agreement, a non-proliferation agreement, which the United States violated and then went on to withdraw from the NPT and to actually produce nuclear weapons. So we certainly don't want that to happen. I think it's a question of whether you want Iran to be a few weeks away from developing sufficient material for a bomb or some months away, and whether you want to have that provision in effect for almost another decade. Andrea talked about more pressure, about getting the Europeans back on board with more pressure. And if only the sanctions had lasted a little longer. I'm sorry, we had quite an experiment under the Trump administration, and the sanctions not only did not lead to improvement in terms of Iran's nuclear program and regional activities or human rights abuses, it led to much worse. It undermined those in Iran who had supported engagement with the West, and we now have perhaps the most repressive right-wing government in Iran since the revolution. So that experiment failed. I don't think we should go back to that.
So back to you, Andrea Stricker. Many critics of the deal also would like to link the deal with the importance of going after Iran's malign activities in the region. But technically, the current deal, or the one that's on the table, and of course the original deal, never really precluded the United States or any party to the deal from attacking Iran or in any way trying to thwart their aggression. What is your take on that particular aspect? Just to make sure that the deal itself doesn't preclude that from happening and that the parties such as the United States or Europe, you know, wouldn't feel in any way constrained to punish Iran, to thwart its actions through its proxies and so forth.
Sure. I think the 2015 deal did put our strongest sanctions in a box. So essentially, we could not confront the whole of the Iranian threat. I think where the Trump administration miscalculated with its pressure campaign was giving differing and likely impossible objectives to the campaign. So stating that they sought a better deal just gave critics ammunition to say that the policy wasn't working when that deal was not forthcoming. But in terms of forcing the regime to make tough choices, such as not paying its foreign militias, that was successful. We saw the Iranian GDP go down from 12.5% in 2016, the first year of the JCPOA, to around 5.4% in 2018. Inflation was soaring. Their foreign reserves went from over $122 billion in 2018 to about $12 billion in 2020. A lot of which was frozen assets abroad. So, I mean, the economic indicators indicate that the campaign was working. It was making the regime feel the pain. I mean, of course, Iran is going to lash out at these policies. It's going to also provide ammunition for critics to say that it just leads to more Iranian attacks. But I would argue that if the U.S. and its allies don't confront the root cause of these issues, which is a regime that is emboldened and not deterred from making trouble in the region, then we'll just have to deal with it at some further point. If we give them a nuclear deal that provides them with probably more than $100 billion in frozen assets and paves the way to a nuclear weapons program, essentially, that's not addressing the root of this issue.
Well, Barbara, I'm sure you have something to say about that.
I sure do. The people who suffered from the sanctions were the Iranian people. The regime did not. The elite did not. And, you know, I hope we won't see this in the case of Russia as well with Ukraine. But what tends to happen is that those with access to hard currency do just fine and everyone else suffers. So, yes, the society has been impoverished. Civil society has been ruined by these sanctions. But the government has not changed its policies in terms of intervention in the region at all. And we saw tremendous escalation. I mean, we nearly went to war with the Iranians after there were attacks on a Saudi oil facility, on Emirati oil tankers. And the Trump administration assassinated Iran's most prominent general, Qasem Soleimani. So I think the alternative to an agreement is more tension and possibly even a military confrontation, which is, again, something that we want to avoid at all cost. sure, you know, it would be great if you could snap your fingers and Iranians would get to vote for the sort of government that they actually want. But in the real world, that doesn't happen. And to base a policy on such a vision, I think, is very dangerous, as well as being, frankly, a bit delusional. The best guarantee we have that Iran will not, cannot develop a nuclear weapon within the foreseeable future is a return to the JCPOA.
Barb, I want to ask you a quick follow-up with respect to the same question I asked Andrea, and that is, the deal, should it actually go through, does not preclude the United States or any of the European powers from going after Iran's malign activities, right? That would not constitute a violation of the deal, correct?
This is a nuclear agreement. Hopefully, if it's revived, it can lead to discussions on other issues. And we have seen, in fact, that the Arab countries that have been rivals of Iran, countries like Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates that were opposed to the agreement back in 2015, now support it. They also have restarted talks with the Iranians on restoring diplomatic relations, on dealing with some of the issues of contention, like the war in Yemen, which is costing everyone horrifically, especially, of course, the Yemeni people, reducing tensions in Iraq, guaranteeing freedom of navigation in the Persian Gulf. All of these things can flow from a revived JCPOA. Without that as a foundation, though, sanctions remain. It's very difficult, obviously, for Iran to revive its economic connections with its neighbors. So it will be more difficult, I think, to de-escalate in the region. We'll probably see more attacks on Americans in Iraq and in Syria, as we saw under the Trump administration. And we may also see more tension between Israel and Iran in Syria. So I think the most important thing, as I said, this is like a keystone in an arch, in a bridge. You need to restore this in order to be able to facilitate other kinds of negotiations with Iran.
So, Andrea, what about that? Isn't that relatively significant? Now, we know Israel, if I'm not mistaken, is still opposed to this revived deal. But the fact that the Gulf states who originally opposed the 2015 deal are now on board, isn't that significant?
Well, I would argue they're not on board. In fact, if you talk to them privately, they're very against this deal because it legalizes Iran's uranium enrichment program and provides it with billions of dollars in sanctions relief. So just because they signed on to a generic statement in support of the United States, that doesn't mean that they support this JCPOA. But I think it actually does make conflict more likely, especially with Israel. Freeing up $86 to $131 billion for Tehran, we know it will use the funds for its foreign militias and groups in Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, and Yemen. We're actually leaving our allies in the region alone. We're leaving Israel alone to deal with the Iranian threat on its own. And I think we do need to examine the premise behind the deal. So in essence, it is based on extortion. Iran is extorting the West for sanctions relief in return for just a few temporary constraints on its enrichment program. And if you believe that one should not punish aggression, but instead find ways to accommodate it, then this deal is for you. But typically, extortionate relationships don't work out very well for the party that pays. So I think we're going to have to deal with the threat. If the Biden administration is hoping to pivot out of the Middle East, they'll probably quickly realize that they'll be sucked right back in.
And lastly, Barb Slavin, there's also talk about offsetting the U.S. ban on Russian oil and gas with oil and gas from Iran. Does that make consummating a deal more urgent? Or should it give us even more pause?
Well, I think it does make it more urgent. You know, an addition of another million barrels of oil a day on the market would certainly help to calm some of the inflationary pressures that we're seeing because of Ukraine. So it's still my hope that they'll get this agreement back together. I have a basic difference of opinion with Andrea, as is completely obvious. I think that this was an important agreement. I don't think it was a result of extortion. I think it was something that satisfied the national interests of the United States, the Iranians, the Russians, the Chinese, the Europeans, and indeed many in Israel and the security establishment there supported it. And the same is true of many of the Arab countries across the Persian Gulf. We have learned through sad experience that a deal is better than no deal.
Well, Andrea Stricker, you get the last word regarding the fact that this is not a permanent deal and that analysts argue that having a deal is certainly better than no deal. And also with respect to offsetting the U.S. ban on Russian oil and gas with oil and gas from Iran, that could be a positive thing as well.
So on oil, I think we can't start buying oil from one nefarious regime just to cut off another. That's not a solution. We need to find alternative sources. So pursuing Iranian and Venezuelan oil is not the answer. We don't want to prop up these regimes anymore.
Ladies, on that note, that's about all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my terrific guest, Barbara Slavin, Director of the Future of Iran Initiative at the Atlantic Council, and Andrea Stricker, Research Fellow at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. Encounter was produced in Washington with technical assistance from Rick Pantaleo. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on The Voice of America.